On the Year That Made Me a few weeks ago, we spoke with a trailblazer in the skies, Deborah Laurie, who won the fight to become the first female pilot for a major Australian commercial airline, ANSET. And that interview led to a very welcome message from a Radio National listener suggesting another guest for The Year That Made Me. That was an SMS, but you can also text in via ABC Listen or email us at sundayextra@abc.net.au. But thanks to that message, our guest on The Year That Made Me today is another trailblazer, but this time under the ground. In 1978, Chris Wilson became the first woman to work underground in a mine in Tasmania. These days, Chris is a visual artist, a tour guide, and she lives in a colourful Romani-style caravan that she's designed on the west coast of Tasmania. Chris Wilson, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you very much, Julian.
Chris, I wonder if we could start with your early years. Could you describe your childhood for us?
I grew up from parents who had just emigrated from England. And they'd come out to Tasmania and settled in Burnie. So my early years were all in the Burnie area, and it was a fairly standard suburb with little conventional houses, but there was plenty of open space and natural sort of bush areas not too far away. And my siblings and I found that we were often left to our own devices with parents who both worked. And I spent a lot of my childhood when I wasn't at school with my brother roaming around and just exploring the local area. And we had a huge amount of freedom, and we did things. We went places with no supervision, and we were just free agents just roaming around. And I guess that lifestyle has carried on with me in many ways, because I love nothing more than to go exploring and roaming around and have the freedom to do that. So, yes, a fairly carefree childhood. I would say it was a bit devoid of parental affection and interaction. Our parents weren't all that interested in what we were doing. But that's life. It takes all sorts. And I know my parents were hardworking. They both had their struggles in life, and they did the best they could.
Well, it sounds like a pretty nice place and way to grow up, Chris, but do you feel, looking back on it, that there were some downsides of that parental detachment as well?
Yes, but it's funny, I wasn't aware of it until I was a bit older and I went to visit friends and saw how their family interacted. It was only then that I realised that there was a whole chunk of being a child in a family that I was missing out on. So, yeah, I did sort of think to myself, well, do our parents really love us? And it was a little bit sad at times, but I guess I've been so used to that, I just thought, well, this is the way it is. And I guess what came from that was a determination that whenever the day came that I was a parent myself, that I would choose to have a balance between giving a child freedom and to learn independence, but at the same time giving them that background love and support and, you know, show an interest in what they were doing.
Chris, you went to university and studied what you call your three loves. What were they?
Well, I would have preferred to have got a career in the outdoors somehow, but that wasn't really an option back in the days when I was considering which path to take. So I thought, well, failing that, my second option was to work with young children. And so I decided the best career for me would be to train as a teacher, specifically with younger children. So I undertook a diploma of teaching. And fortunately for me, the way the course was structured, you could pick two majors that didn't have to relate to your teaching direction. So it was easy. Study early childhood education, major in my two loves, which were geology and art. And I know that's a mix of the arts and the sciences, yes, but it worked for me. And I think as the decades have gone by, I see more and more that the two subjects can happily marry and inspire one another.
Chris, where had those enthusiasms for art and geology come from?
I think the art had been there from a very young child, and that may have been to do with so much time on my own. So I began doing a lot of drawings, and I realised at school early on that art was one of my favourite subjects. And geology, I think, was more from my father. He wasn't a hands-on dad, but he did do some interesting stuff of his own. He was a bit of a solo man. When he wasn't working, he would often go off on these little adventures with his kayak and come back with a few hair-raising stories.
You've conjured up visions of a very prominent 1980s ad for Solo with me, Chris.
Yeah. And he also came back with mineral and rock specimens and just kept them lying around. And I guess me seeing his kayak, his rock collection, was quite likely a trigger for me to go on to become a kayaker and, of course, my interest in geology. I do have to thank my father for that, I suppose, yeah.
And geology, of course, became an important part of your career later on, but that was after your teaching. What was it like being a teacher, Chris?
Well, I was given a posting to Queenstown. I was quite happy because I already had a strong connection to the West Coast through the geology course that I'd been doing. Anyone who's anyone in Tasmania, if they're interested in geology, the West Coast is a must. It's geology central. Yeah. There's so much of interest, and in particular Queenstown. So I was already familiar with the landscape, and it was no problem for me to be sent to the West Coast. In fact, it was, thank you very much. you've done a great job.
And this indeed was in 1976, which is the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, Chris.
Yes, I arrived in Queenstown in early 1976. I had just got my driver's license, and I decided that I had a real desire to get into some four-wheel driving, because a lot of the West Coast, if you didn't have a four-wheel drive, was out of reach to you. So I bought myself a little four-wheel drive and headed into the mining town of Queenstown to set up as a kindergarten teacher. I was also getting quite advanced in my kayaking skills. And as far as I was concerned, I had a great little life set out in front of me in Queenstown with all my interests as well as my career. And everything went really well for the first half of the year, meeting up with like-minded people, going for kayak paddles, exploring by four-wheel drive. Teaching went well, and I thought everything was going great. But it wasn't that long before things came crashing down.
Yeah, so tell us about that, Chris.
Well, the town of Queenstown back then was really all about the Mount Lyell copper mine, and there was quite a vibrant community based on the workforce. I'd actually met a mining engineer and was in a relationship with him. And towards the end of 1976, the mine was in financial difficulties. They decided to lay off a huge amount of their workforce, and amongst them was my boyfriend. So he was then heading off to the mainland to another mine somewhere. And that was the end of our relationship. Also, in about the middle of the year, I was chosen to represent the state in a canoeing competition on the mainland, and I was training for that. But then I got glandular fever, which can really knock you around.
Yeah, really debilitating.
Yeah. In my case, it was quite severe. And the beginning of that illness, I had to get out of the house I was living in, find somewhere else to live. I couldn't teach, so I had to get time off work. I was too ill to train for the canoeing team, so I had to withdraw from the team. The last blow to me towards the end of 1976, and I see it as one of those things, good, bad, you know.
Tough at the time, but something good came of it?
Something definitely good came of it, because the hierarchy of the school I was at had decided that my personal lifestyle was unbecoming of a kindergarten teacher.
What?
Yes. They thought it was unbecoming of a young single woman to share a rented house with a married couple and my boyfriend.
Wow.
I spent my personal time four-wheel driving and canoeing, and that was unheard of. They decided they would transfer me out. I didn't want to go, but they said, "You're going, we're moving you up to Burnie." And I was pretty horrified because I'd just come from Burnie and I was glad to, sorry, Burnie, but I was glad to get out. But what it did do was instill in me this determination to get back to the West Coast again and say, you know, you're not going to wreck my life around just because of these whimsical things. And I actually confronted the principal of the school and they actually told me to my face the reason they were moving me. They said, "You're a good teacher, but your lifestyle is not suitable."
Just extraordinary. And on top of all the other things you were going through, made for a hell of a challenge. But it sounds like you emerged from 1976, Chris, with a pretty steely determination to get back to the west coast of Tasmania. What happened over the next couple of years before we get to the year that you became the first woman to work underground in a mine in Tasmania?
Well, I begrudgingly moved up to Burnie and started at my new school. I wasn't enjoying it. I was missing the West Coast and I almost immediately began looking for another job. So I scoured the newspapers and found there was a position available based in Zeehan, working for a mining exploration company. And it was quaintly called an assistant prospecting hand.
What does an assistant prospecting hand do, Chris?
Basically assists the chief, the geologist, in the activities looking for minerals. And often that could be pared down to a lackey who does the manual labour. Dig that hole, cut that line, you know, fairly manual labour type tasks.
And without putting too fine a point on it, it sounds like that's the sort of task that might be quite challenging for a young woman in 1970s Tasmania to take on, not least someone whose last job was as a primary school teacher.
Yes, and I take my hat off to this guy who must have seen something in me and said, "Right, I'll give you a go." And that involved a lot of outdoor work, and that was something I was really pleased to be doing. Enjoyed my time. I got promoted from assistant prospecting hand to prospecting hand.
Were you the only woman in that job?
Yeah, we were a very small operation out of Zeehan and I wasn't aware of any other females at the time. Oh, I just had this funny thought. Can I tell you a funny thought?
Please.
My boss and I were out in the bush near a place called Tulla and we were doing magnetic surveys. That's what helps you discover ore bodies because of the magnetic variations. And I was the one carrying all the magnetic gear. And we were walking along this track and it was full of water puddles. And I'm walking along, sloshing through the puddles with my gear. And I said to my boss, "I'm assuming that all these puddles are not too deep." And I kid you not, within a few minutes of saying that, I stepped in a puddle right up to my middle.
Oh, no.
It had been a test hole for a power pole and it had filled in with water and it looked like any other of the puddles, but when I stepped in it, up to my waist. Hilarious.
Well, yeah, I suppose that'll teach you to make observations like that. I bet you were more cautious about making observations after that experience.
Yes, like the next observation. Because it was raining, I said, "Oh, we probably won't have to worry about snakes." That was another thing I should have shut up about.
Yeah, right. Well, I hope you didn't get too much of a reputation on the work site after those couple of incidents. But clearly, Chris, you also were keeping an eye on the job ads that you'd mentioned, because even though it sounds like things were going well as an assistant prospector who was now a prospector themselves, you before long saw another ad in the newspaper, and it had a particularly intriguing description. Could you tell us about the ad and the description?
Sure. I thought I was ready to move on from that job and was looking through the newspaper ads again. And there's one that was labelled Wanted Geological Technician. It was a step up on the ladder up to actual geologist work. And the person who'd written it had made a bit of a comment that females need not be deterred from applying for this very interesting position. And I thought, great. And I did apply for it and I did get it. And the chief geologist of the Renison Mine, Lindsay Newnham, did say to me at one point, you know, I wrote that with you in mind. He had obviously heard about me when I was working as the assistant prospecting hand and decided he wanted me on the team.
So, Chris, it certainly sounds like with that phrase, females need not be deterred from applying for this very interesting position, that the job was calling out for you. And indeed, it was calling out for you. And that, I think, allowed you to advance beyond the role that you began in and gave you the opportunity to work underground. How did that happen?
Yeah, so Renison had two aspects to its geological team. There was the mine and then there was the exploration side. So you could either be working at the mine and underground, or you could be working for the same company but doing out in the field exploration works, and they're all surface. So I'd been there a little while and my boss said, you know, he's looking at what I'm doing and he feels that it's time for me to decide which direction I want to go in. And he gives me the option, do you want to work on the surface in the exploration department or would you be interested in working underground? And I just said, yes, please, underground. He did then say to me, I do have to write to the mines department for permission because there were no other females employed in underground positions in Tasmania at least. In the rest of Australia, it's not quite so clear what the situation was back in 1978. I'm aware that Western Australia had a no women underground policy.
You could get fined for it.
If a woman was caught underground before about 1980-ish, the company could be fined. Mm. So I was very fortunate that the mines department wrote back and said, yes, permission granted.
That's great. Yeah, and it sounds like you certainly had support from Lindsay Newham. What about from your other working colleagues? It must have been quite a challenging thing to be that first woman in an underground role in a mine in Tasmania.
Most of them took it in their stride without any problem, and they were very supportive. There was only one young fellow who was a recent uni graduate who was a bit funny about it, but whether it was because of my sex or whether it was because I was working my way up through the system rather than leaving university with a shiny geology degree. But the people who were the most oppositional were what you would call the blokes, the truck drivers, the diamond drillers. They were quite opposed to the idea, and I got this impression by the way they spoke about me, the way they looked at me, and sometimes the way they challenged my being there with behaviours.
Yeah, so what sort of things would they do to indicate their hostility to your presence?
Fairly early on, there was a guy who was meant to show me how to get to this particular place underground, and Renison Underground is a real rabbit warren. And I was meant to be following him to get to this place. So he took off in front of me in his vehicle and I was following. But he was going pretty fast because he knew the area very well. And when it came to a junction, and there were many, you could go left, right here or straight ahead, he didn't wait. He left me to follow and to try and figure out which direction he took. So it was obvious that he wasn't concerned that I was taking the right turn. And it was almost like a game of, well, see if you can find me. And he did not wait at any of these junctions. So I had to use my better judgments and my skills. And at one point I had to get out of the vehicle and stop and look at the fresh tracks in the mud to see which of the directions had the freshest tracks. So I knew which way they'd gone. And I eventually got to the right place, which I was very pleased about.
Yeah, it sounds like you were not going to let them get in the way of the work that you were going to do. And it seems like on some occasions you actually did the job better than some of the blokes who are a bit hostile towards you.
That new graduate that was a bit anti-me being there, yeah. He had all the intellectual smarts, but what he didn't have was actual practical experience and the actual eyes on the rock knowledge. You've got to be observant underground when you're looking at the rocks, and you've got to pick up on little clues that give you a hint. And this particular fellow had organised for a drill operator to begin drilling a hole towards where he decided the ore body should be. But then he had to go away, and I was left in charge of this particular project. And I went down to have a look at the drillers, and they were ready to drill in an upwards direction. And while they were setting up, I just had a bit of a look around at the rocks, as I always do. And I noticed a particular marker bed, very small little layer of pebbles. And it tells you that below it, not far away, is the ore body. And he'd missed it. He'd just looked at his maps and gone, well, the ore's up there. And I looked at the pebble bed marker and said to the drilling team, stop, you're not going to be drilling up, you're going to be drilling down. And they looked at me and, are you sure? And I said, yep. And so they switched directions and drilled the hole downwards and hit the ore body. So the fellow, when he got back, had to kind of mumble, okay.
Yeah. On the year that made me, we're speaking with Chris Wilson, who in 1978 became the first woman to work underground in a mine in Tasmania. And Chris, as well as the underground work that you were doing, you were continuing with your passion for kayaking, I understand it, and got involved in the Gordon River Preservation Society. Indeed, you kayaked down the Franklin not long after Bob Brown did. What was it like being part of the Gordon River campaign?
Oh, it was good, yeah. In 1976, that year of all kinds of things, I met a group of people in the town who'd formed this society, Gordon River Preservation Society, and they were a lovely group of people. So I got involved with that campaign back in the very early days when Bob Brown was starting up the Tasmanian Wilderness Society. Bob Brown rafted the Franklin in 1976, I believe. So that was a big year for him. And it was not that long afterwards that plans came together for my particular trip down the Franklin, because I believed that if I was going to be passionate about trying to save it, I should at least make an effort to paddle down the river itself. Because the Wilderness Society, or Tasmanian Wilderness Society, as they were known initially, were ramping up their campaign, the Gordon River Preservation Society did eventually have a get-together at Bob Brown's Liffey property, and we decided that we would merge our resources. So the Gordon River Preservation Society was no longer. But it was exciting times. It was a bit like the Wild West. If you were in Queenstown and you were in favour of saving the Franklin, you had to be very careful who you spoke to. Mm. The sentiment in the town was very divided. Mostly people were supportive of the dams, and the very few people that were brave enough to take the opposite stance were often subject to verbal abuse and, in some extreme cases, physical abuse.
And interestingly enough, Chris, Not only did you choose 1976 as the year that made you, but Bob Brown is a former guest on The Year That Made Me earlier this year, and he chose 1976 as well. He calls it his year of reformation, and in particular, the decision to raft down the Franklin River. Now, Chris, we've talked about your work in mining, but you mentioned another love earlier on, your love of being an artist. Could you tell us a little bit about your art practice, not least because I've seen some of your works and I think your love of not only the Tasmanian wilderness, but also your interest in geology comes out in your work?
Yes, it does. I've always been drawn to landscape painting. And for the first probably couple of decades at least, I was mainly interested in painting the wild areas, the forests and the rivers, the mountains and the seas of the West Coast, because I thought they were so special. But then in more recent times, particularly since moving back to Queenstown after a long break away, I decided to make my works more geological and chose the mountainous areas of the Queenstown area as inspiration for most of my artworks. That would sometimes involve showing the whole landscapes, you know, distant views, but then often a cameo close-up of a particular rock type. So you can see the mountain ranges in the background, and in the foreground you see a close-up of what those mountain ranges are actually made of. And I found the colours, the textures, the patterns, the bold shapes, they were just really, really special to, you know, show in a painting.
And Chris, I've got to ask you about your caravan, because as I mentioned in the introduction, you designed it yourself. I believe it's called the Magic Gypsy Caravan. Tell us about the Magic Gypsy Caravan, Chris.
Okay. For a few years when I was first married, I lived in Queensland, and one of the little places I lived in was a timber cottage built in a rainforest, and it was such a delightful building in a setting that was pretty special. I actually called it the Magic Cottage because it had that magical feel. Mm. Then many years later, when I moved back to the West Coast and bought a little cottage in Strawn, it had the makings of also becoming a magic cottage. And I spent about 20 years planting a rainforest in the garden and making magic cottage number two, if you like. That's where I first began my little art gallery business. And I would paint and sell my artwork from the Magic Cottage Art Gallery. Now, fast forward quite a bit more, and I found myself living in different circumstances with a son who was about to move out of home. And I decided that if I was going to be on my own with a limited budget, I would probably want to have a different way of living. So I thought I will make plans for a special caravan, not just anyone, one that I felt would be a work of art in itself, and it would be my home, that I could either stay somewhere or travel. And I researched gypsy caravan styles and came up with a bit of a compromise of all the different styles, drew some plans, made a model, and then found a company in Tasmania that said they could make it for me. But I'll often get people who say to me, "Gee, you've done some interesting jobs, you've been into some really cool places, you know, you've had a really interesting life." And I will agree with them, but then I will add, if I had to say what was the most rewarding job in my life, I would without doubt tell them it was being a mother. I have two wonderful boys, and I think being a parent has been the most rewarding job for me.
Chris, it's been delightful speaking with you on The Year That Made Me. Thank you so much for joining us.
No worries. Thank you.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us and why?
Well, around about 1975, 1976, 1977, one of my favourite bands was Fleetwood Mac. Who doesn't love Fleetwood Mac? So I went through all my favourite Fleetwood Mac songs, and the one that stood out for me, that resonated the most, and the one I remember enjoying listening to was a song called Landslide. So that's my choice of song.
So here it is, Landslide by Fleetwood Mac. And Chris Wilson, the first woman who worked in an underground mine in Tasmania, thank you once again.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.